From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. To a lot of Americans, Texas is kind of like your dear old aunt at the family gatherings. A little too brash, politically a little extreme, but she's entertaining and, Lord knows, part of the family. Columnist Gail Collins has had a lot of fun tweaking the Texan nose over the years, but one day she realized it's no joke. Texas, she says, has had an outsized role in this nation's modern destiny, giving us everything from presidents to our textbooks to our tax policies. This hour, On Point, the Lone Star State and the American Agenda. You can join the conversation. How do you think the Lone Star State has influenced the national agenda? How has LBJ, two Bushes, one Rick Perry, an army of Dick Army Republicans changed America? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from New York, not Texas, is Gail Collins, New York Times national columnist. Her new book is called As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. And by the way, you can read an excerpt of Gail's book on our website at onpointradio.org. Welcome to On Point, Gail Collins.
Thank you, Jackie. Good to be here.
So it's fascinating to go along on this ride with you. You have been writing about Texas, as we pointed out, for a very long time, but you got particularly interested in 2009. What happened?
Yeah, that was when the famous Rick Perry secession speech happened. And he did not actually call for secession. He just gave a speech vigorously attacking the federal government to a large group of people waving secede signs. And then afterwards said that he certainly didn't expect to break up the union, but if Washington continued to be so awful, who knows what might happen. And it didn't sound to me like a real commitment. I don't know, you know. And so I thought, wow, why? And they were so angry. You know, there were tons of Tea Party rallies going on in Texas at that point in time. And I kept thinking, this is the state that runs the country. You know, most of the national agenda has been set by Texas or Texans over the last 30 years. Why are they so ticked off? And so I kind of went to Texas to explore.
We have just a little clip here, not precisely from that rally at the Tea Party in Austin. You wrote there were rallies at that point after the stimulus every time at Cow Mood. But this is from, I think, right around that time in March in 2009, Governor Perry is speaking to conservative bloggers from the governor's office in Austin, and he's complaining about the policies coming out of President Obama's Washington and warning that tape is pretty good, but maybe not the best. Here we go.
Texans do have a little different feeling about independence. And when we came into the nation in 1845, we were a republic. We were a standalone nation. And one of the deals was we can leave anytime we want.
Yeah.
So we're kind of thinking about that again.
Well, leave any time Texas wants. Thinking about it again, that's kind of what got you going and why they were so, as you put it, ticked off.
Yeah, and they actually can't leave anytime they want. That's one of the Texas sort of myths. But you're not feeling the love if you're another state and you're hearing stuff like that.
So you decide you're going to go, and you start with the history lesson. You go to the Alamo.
I went to the Alamo a couple of times, and I went to the state capitol. The Alamo is very every school child, I swear, in Texas goes on a pilgrimage to the Alamo at some point or another. It's very sort of central to Texas feeling of Texasness and self-identity. And I found it interesting because my only thought about the Alamo until then had been that Davy Crockett died there, and I saw that when I was a kid on TV. And then I found out that maybe Davy Crockett didn't die there, which was a real trauma. But he may have been captured and died later. We don't know. But when I went in and I was listening to the story, and I thought, wow, this is heroic men with a very bad plan. This is, you know, these guys should not have died there. They should have just gotten out and gone to fight again the next day. But that vision of the independent stand, you know, taking a possibly losing but very violently felt independent stand for yourself is just very central, I think, to Texas identity.
Now, there's things about Texas that in terms of its eccentricities, you mentioned that I think we've all come to cherish the idea of beauty pageants or the Dallas Cowboys or some of the more eccentric people and entertainers and even politicians have come out. But you wanted to look at what was it? What agenda was it that you think Texas is setting that the rest of us must follow that you think is a contradiction to their feeling so oppressed by policies from Washington?
Well, the first contradiction is the fact that Texas feels so oppressed, but in fact, Texas has been setting the agenda for the rest of us to a great extent. I don't want to oversell my point, but look at the savings and loan crisis in the 80s. That happened after Ronald Reagan restructured the federal rules for savings and loans based on the ones in Texas because the Texas SNLs were doing so well. This was actually because many of them were cooking their books, but he hadn't noticed that at that point in time. So that was in the 80s. The deregulation of the financial markets, which we have all come to feel in recent years, no one person is responsible. There were so many fingers in that pot in Washington. But I think you could argue that one of the very biggest fingers in the pot was that of Senator Phil Graham, who was head of the Senate Banking Committee. And No Child Left Behind. The way the federal government runs its programs to support public schools in this country was based on George W. Bush's Texas experience. And then you have energy, you have the environment. When George W. ran for president, the Republican platform said that as president, he would take care of the environment nationally just the way he had in Texas, which was terrifying because at that point, Texas had the worst pollution problems in the country. And, you know, all the land wars that I've in my lifetime have been fought under Texan presidents. So there's a bunch.
We might just point out that you are from Ohio, which has more presidents sent to the White House than Texas. But
it's true.
Just doesn't feel like it.
Well, then, you know, the Ohio presidents were not particularly Ohioan. You know, and Ohio people don't run around with shirts saying, you know, don't mess with Ohio. And we did not pledge allegiance to the Ohio flag. There's a sense of selfness about Texas that I think is really unique.
Would you talk about your whole philosophy of empty spaces? That's one of the things that you really establish here. And that it does come into this uniqueness, this Texan identity.
Yeah, I had always thought when I was covering Congress more that when you would see how people would phrase arguments, you know, before it became so bipolar as it is right now, that the real division was often not between just Republicans and Democrats. It was between people who regarded themselves as representing crowded places and people who felt they were representing empty places. And when you live in a crowded place or perceive yourself as living in a crowded place, you really appreciate government because it's government that protects you from burglars. It's government that keeps dogs from pooping on the sidewalk. It's government that keeps sewers from exploding. You know, there's all kinds of things when people are crowded together that might happen to you. And government protects you. And it's a positive thing. If you perceive yourself as living in an empty place where you're all on your own and you're not bothering anybody else and you don't want anybody to bother you, then government is useless. It's an intrusion. It just bothers you. It takes taxes away from you. And that vision, that empty place vision, is the great power of Texas is that if you're the problem with empty place government, the empty place political theory is that if you are an empty place, you don't have any people and therefore you don't have much political power. I'm not going to write a book about how Wyoming hijacked the national agenda, but mm-hmm. Texas has tons of people, and most of them, 80%, live in metropolitan areas, but yet it's managed to maintain its vision of itself as an empty place.
Well, of course,
partly because it's so huge. People drive 300 miles to go to a football game without thinking about it.
Well, of course, Texas, you say that a lot of them are really living in mega suburbs, suburbanopolises, if you will, that really have nothing to do with the wide open spaces concept.
Yeah, but you do. And it's interesting. It's partly just that you decide that that's what you feel that you are. You live in an empty place in your mind, whether you do or not. But besides that, in Texas, really, it's so – I didn't know this until I did this book. Texas is so huge that if it was as crowded as New York City, which it does not intend to ever be, the entire planet could fit in Texas. It is so big. And so even though you're living in Houston – you've got to drive a long way to get home. You might drive 40, 50, 60, 70 miles within metropolitan Houston just to get home at night. So you don't really feel as if, even though you're in a suburb, you do, there's that sense that things go on forever, that it's very wide open and empty.
Yeah. And it, we should say it is the second biggest state in the union in terms of population, largest in landmass. You just pointed that out. We'll get to
well,
some...
Well, if Alaska melts, I think that would be...
largest in the lower 48. Yes. And we hope Alaska won't. Gail, stick with us. We're speaking with New York Times columnist and author Gail Collins. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and you are listening to On Point.
Her love is flowing like a Rio Grande. I'm crazy about her, don't you understand? So now don't look for me in Mexico. Oh, there's no reason to go. Now I know everything is better here in Texas. There's no place like my old San Antonio. Dance in the floor and hello.
On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the state of Texas and its big influence on the rest of the country's politics. And my guest is New York Times national columnist Gail Collins about her new book, As Goes Texas. Gail, we've been getting a lot of calls during our break, so let's go to a few of them. Robert is calling in from Burlington, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, Robert.
Hi. I was born in Perryton, Texas, and I didn't grow up in Texas. But I have relatives, of course, from Texas. And while there are a lot of decent and lousy people everywhere, it just seems to me a little bit remarkable that to the degree of just blatant self-centeredness and self-righteousness and the sense of entitlement that Texans have to run the place and to be the boss and stuff. I would say, for me, the opposite of Texas is Vermont. And this is the state where we have we ban billboards from the highways instead of having them blatantly out there messing up the landscape. We had civil unions before anybody else did. Probably we will be the state that has single-payer health care before any other state does. And it's a state where just, you know, like Texas, it was once an independent nation. But the attitude that comes out of people here is just so much different. And I've heard some commentators from Fox cite that difference, that, you know, they thought that Vermont was hopeless. And from my point of view, somebody who thinks that Texas is a great place,
All right.
My state is hopeless. Well, I'm pretty pleased with it.
All right. Robert, I'm going to put you down as a Vermonter, even if you were born in Texas. Gail, is Vermont the opposite?
Well, it sort of is. I was interested when I went through the state capitol in Texas that, you know, that there's so much, a very strong self-awareness of the fact that Texas was once an independent republic. It means so much to Texans. And Vermont was actually an independent republic longer than Texas was, but it doesn't come up in Vermont. I mean, I've never heard anybody in Vermont talk about it. But on the other hand, I do want to say in defense of Texans after your caller that when I was there, I was just bowled over by the graciousness of the people that I met. And I particularly whenever I talk to groups that, you know, I feel that I'm stirring up in this sort of anti-Texas way. Houston, Texas, after Hurricane Katrina, took in 200,000 refugees from Louisiana. I cannot imagine easily New York City taking in 200,000 refugees from Newark if they had a hurricane. So you got to give Texans a little more credit, I think, than your last caller did.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the political cast of characters that you mentioned and get into some of the political dimensions that you examined. When we think of Texas politicians today, we do think, I mean, some people are going to remember LBJ. We're also, of course, Presidents Bushes, both of them, Rick Perry, the candidate, Dick Armey, leading Congress. How have these particular Texans, do you think, changed the debate? Lee Atwater, most of them Republican.
Karl Rove.
Yeah. Karl Rove, of course. Thank you for that. How have they changed the political climate, in your judgment?
Well, the interesting thing is that for a very long time, of course, most of the people in Texas were Democrats, which was a leftover from the Civil War, and it's not much different from many of the southern states. But once Robert Caro told me that, you know,
the great biographer of Lyndon Johnson,
that the last time he went to Texas, he found that all of the people who had been LBJ people who were still around had all become Republicans, he said. But what surprised him was that they were such violent Republicans. When they changed, they really flipped over in a big way. And there is that they brought both to the Republican Party. I think Texas brought both the amount of money there. I mean, money talks everywhere in American politics, and especially recently. But it's been really yelling in Texas for a long time. So there was a ton of money. And there was that open spaces kind of ideology that Texans are really, really comfortable with, and those outside personalities. And Lyndon Johnson, who was the most remarkable president certainly since Franklin Roosevelt, brought all of the populism that he had picked up growing up in the Hill Country and teaching poor Mexican-American students when he was a teacher, and then attached that to all of the moneyed interest he had befriended by bringing contracts back to Texas for all of the big firms, and created a Democratic Party in Texas that, as long as he lasted, was both really amazing and also, you know, he had a very strong liberal root over there on one side. But Democrats have not won a state election in Texas since 1994, and that's a 99-0 record. I mean, it's a poor, pathetic little thing right now.
And we're talking about every state office, whether it's treasurer or name one, I don't know, since 1994.
Yep. And they vote for judges statewide, too, so that does add to the group, but no Democrats.
When you talk about Robert Caro and what he told you about their such strikingly violent Republicans, what sort of – I mean, are you talking about being anti-tax? Are you talking about being in support of no regulation? Are you talking about winner-take-all politics? What?
The very, very strongest thing of all, I think, is the sense of states' rights, that Texas – and it's also part of that. We used to be an independent place for a little bit. Texas's sense of – states' rights is really, really, really intense. And one of the things I tried to do in the book was to examine that theory of I'll leave you alone and you leave me alone, and whether or not states do leave each other alone when they just go on their own way. And I took a look at things in Texas, like, for instance, there's been a war on family planning going on in Texas for the last few years, and there's virtually no public funding of family planning anymore in Texas. The schools teach abstinence-only sex education for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, the highest birth rate in the country, one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates in the country. Now, what does that mean for those of us who aren't in Texas? Well, one thing it means is that 60% of the deliveries are the women who are pregnant who have their babies delivered to hospital, 60% of those are paid for by Medicaid because the women are so poor. Now, as a federal government, the federal government pays for half the cost of Medicaid. So that is, you know, billions of dollars that other taxpayers are paying. And God bless us, it's the best thing you could possibly do to help make sure that poor women have safe deliveries. But it would seem to me that in return, the rest of the country has some right to ask Texas to make sure that women who don't actually want to get pregnant have access to family planning. And you look at that in different things. It works out that way a lot.
I have to say, when you talked about how abstinence must be taught in high schools, you're talking about things like high school teachers having to say the first thing we wanted to – I don't know if this is exclusive to Texas, but you went – the first thing you have to remember is that abstinence always works. It's a practical thing. But then you went on – people got told some really weird stuff.
Yeah, there was a study done a few years ago by the Texas Freedom Network in which they got—
Which is a liberal group, right?
Yes, it is. They got a couple of university professors who are experts in health to do freedom of information requests to find out exactly what all the schools in Texas were teaching in their sex education classes. And it is a fascinating document. There were some schools that were teaching theories about reproduction that have not, I thought, been seen since colonial America, like a woman cannot get pregnant unless she enjoyed the sex. It just went on and on and on. It was just amazing.
We're getting a lot of calls here. We also want to say we misspoke a minute ago. Of course, Lee Atwater might seem like a Texan. Tom DeLay, of course, is the other famous Texas politician we were thinking of. Let's take a phone call here. Daniel is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome to On Point, Daniel.
Hello. My comments that I'm originally from California, but I've lived a lot of places, and Californians are cocky because we have a lot of different stuff and different terrain and whatnot, but the Texans that I met everywhere I went seemed to always be cocky purely because they were from Texas, and they had no other argument to make, no other thing to contribute. It was just the fact that they were from Texas, therefore they were better.
Well, they definitely do think they are from Texas, that's for sure.
All right. Hang on a moment, Gail. I think it's time to bring a Texan into this conversation.
Okay.
And from Dallas, ninth largest city in the nation, home of the Cowboys and J.R. Ewing, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News. Bill, thanks for joining the show. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. I think Bill. I'm not sure.
You have to stick up for the whole state now.
The whole state. All 25 million of us.
But would you speak to Gail's point here? Do you, in your judgment, you're a columnist for the Dallas Morning News, think that there is a contradiction between Texas feeling that it is being dictated to by Washington, and you do hear that a lot from Texas politicians, and at the same time, instituting policies such as in textbooks or tax policies that have a lot of influence on the rest of the country?
Well, I think there's a corollary to this also. I think for a while we in Texas have deplored the federal government, but on the other hand, the federal government through the Defense Department, for example, was one of the reasons the state was able to grow during the post-World War II boom. So, you know, we have benefited from government. I would say, yes, sure, there's going to be a hypocrisy if we're saying that we don't like the federal government, but on the other hand, we're going to do things here that would influence our national politics and et cetera. And Ms. Collins has pointed some of those out in her book. I would say, I think where, if I can say this to you, Gail, I think where you miss it is there's just more nuance that goes on here than seeing this through a monolith of kind of right-wing Republicanism. And let me throw out a couple examples here. I would say our Republican Party here is divided between economic, Chamber of Commerce Republicans, and social conservatives. And they're meeting this weekend in Fort Worth, and we're going to see that divide on display some in their annual convention. But in last year's legislature, there were a couple key moments where the economic Republicans, led by the Texas Association of Business, a conservative group, stood up and said to the governor and others in legislature, look, we got a budget deficit and we need to use our $9 billion surplus that we have in our rainy day fund to help offset some of that. In the Dallas Chamber of Commerce stood up for it. Other business leaders stood up. They pressed back against the right wing on it. Unfortunately, they couldn't persuade the governor to get off the dime. But the fact is, they were the ones standing up to fight it. Likewise, there were a number of anti-immigration, anti-immigrant bills that the far right within the legislature was pushing. Those bills were killed or stifled by the business Republicans. And the third point I would say is we have a water planning process here in Texas, which is kind of on the forefront of water planning around the state. We not only identify what our needs are, we come up with strategies and ways that we need to go take care of it, because water is a big issue here, just like it is in California. And a number of these economic Republicans have been working within the legislature to identify a way to pay for this plan. So, you know, I don't think it's just all The Republican Party here is not all one thing. Last example I'll throw out at this Republican convention this weekend in Fort Worth, the chairman of the Republican Party in Texas has been going around the state saying to his fellow Republicans, you need to look at the Latino growth here in Texas. We can't ignore that. We need to do something about it. In our paper today, we have an editorial applauding him for that and trying to urge the Republican Party of Texas to do what Bush did when he was governor, and that is try to broaden the party.
Bill, we have a clip here, actually. Speaks to your point, and this is during a GOP debate last September outside the state in Orlando, Governor Perry addressing concerns from his peers that his educational policies were favoring illegal immigrants.
Every day I have Texans on that border that are doing their job. But if you say that we should not educate children who have come into our state for no other reason than they've been brought there by no fault of their own, I don't think you have a heart.
Now, as you know very well, Bill, that comment really cost him a lot from other Republican candidates who you were just talking about, the divisions between economic and philosophical. Many people, that was one of the things that cost him the most, never mind his errors and bumbles.
Right. And I should say our newspaper did not endorse him when he ran for re-election to governor in 2010. So I say this as somebody who's not necessarily a periophile, if you will. I thought that was one of his best moments in the campaign because he was very truthful and he was speaking from experience. And he's, you know, this is one of these places, points where I think Texas really can add to the dialogue because our population is shifting, like California's, faster than the rest of the nation. The Latino growth here is driving the population in Texas, and he's reporting what he's seeing, and he was right.
Gail, what do you say to Bill and some of the points about nuance that he's making here?
Well, absolutely nuanced. It's very. This is an outsider's view of Texas, and there's way more nuance in Texas than I could give you credit for in a very short book. But about the point about immigration in particular, I do think, and I did find when I was there, that Texans are less crazy about immigration issues than other border states, particularly Arizona, and that partly because of their very long history, you know, that started as part of Mexico. And Rick Perry was interesting the first time that Mitt Romney laced into him for the policy that Texas has of allowing children who were brought here illegally to qualify as state residents when they go to college. Perry just looked stunned. I mean, he was just doing what he always does. He was following the money. The Texas business interests did want that bill passed. They wanted better educated people in the state. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was their version of the Dream Act. It wasn't quite the Dream Act, mm-hmm. but it was their version. It was a bipartisan bill. But my last point that I would make in general about Texas and how Texas influences the rest of the country, Texas is going to be a majority Hispanic state up in the near future. Texas is, because of its huge population growth, is going to be providing 10% of the workforce of the nation in the future. The degree to which Texas cannot simply not be crazy about immigration, but can actually bring Mexican Americans, other Hispanics into the power structure of the state in politics and in business, and can educate those children so that they can move up and not spend their lives doing minimum wage jobs, which are so helpful to all the business interests. That's the very big deal about where Texas goes.
I wouldn't be an American if it wasn't for Texas. Fort Worth would never cross my mind. There'd be no Austin City limit sign, no Lone Star of any kind, if it wasn't for Texas.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how the Lone Star State has influenced the nation's politics. And we're speaking with Gail Collins. She's the author of As Goes Texas and Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Dallas Morning News, who's checking in with us from the state. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of calls. David is calling from Farmington, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, David.
Jackie, thank you for taking my call. Excellent program. I take issue with your guest's characterization of Texas as hijacking the American political agenda. It brings to mind images of a terrorist. I live in Connecticut. I've grown up in Connecticut my whole life. I've never had a fear of Texas. And if we as a country choose to elect people from Texas, so be it. That's our choice. Democracy rules. Majority wins. And the Republican Party recently, they rejected Rick Perry. He was from Texas. So I'm not in agreement with this Texas hijacking the political agenda. And it, what it sounds like your guest is attacking the principles of democracy because she does not like how the majority has voted when it's chosen people or policies from Texas.
Okay, David, thanks for that point. Let's take another call here. Mary is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Mary.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not from Texas, but my father's side of the family is from Texas, and I'm a former student of Texas A&M University. I'd like to offer a comment about education and get Ms. Collins' comments. I attended Texas A&M at Galveston when the university system was integrating the Cadet Corps, or the ROTC program, and the Merchant Marine Officer Training Program, to go from an all-male student body to a, a mixed, to an integrated student body. And I felt that what drove the very pragmatic and positive approach that the university took to integration was the school's desire not to be dictated to by the federal government. So they wanted to get in ahead of the pack, you know, and set up their programs before the government mandated it. And
And your point, Mary, is that when women were mixed into the academic body, then?
So I wanted to ask a question. So I thought they're very progressive as far as integrating women in into the student body. Okay. And my point, my follow-on question is, I connected, rightly or wrongly, my positive experience of this integration to Texas's substantial record of electing women to public office. And I'm currently working for Elizabeth Warren because I'm so worried here in Massachusetts it's so difficult to elect a woman, and in Texas it's so easy. And I was wondering if...
Gail Collins could speak to that.
Comment,
okay, thank you for that comment, Mary. You know, we have a clip here of Ann Richards, who, of course, was governor of Texas and a Democrat, to speak to Mary's point. She first got the nation's attention at the 1988 Democratic Convention in Atlanta. She got on the podium to praise the Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis and to slam Republican contender George H.W. Bush with their very trademark peppery Texas style.
Poor George. He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
Bill McKenzie, I think of a certain age, everyone remembers that moment. There was just something about the way she said that, and not that it slowed down the Bush presidencies, both of them.
Right. And she... Ann Richards was good for Texas in many ways and be able to showcase the state. But I would also argue there have been a number of Republican women. Kay Hutchinson, senator from the state for the last 20 years, stepping down this year. And at the state level, there are a number of other office holders who are in both parties who are women. So I guess the caller is saying is the state has been able to integrate women into the political structure. And I would say that is... you know, I don't know Massachusetts how to compare it to that very well, but yeah, we do have a track record going on there.
Let's take another call. Tom is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Welcome to On Point, Tom.
Hi, Jackie. This two things. First, I teach criminal justice, a little school here, and one of the impacts that Texas has had on the rest of the states has been the whole field of our overemphasis on imprisonment in criminal justice and also the death penalty. But in an earlier life, I was a military intelligence officer that zipped about Africa and Middle East and Europe. And you asked at the very beginning, is there something about Texas that is uniquely American that appeals? And we forget that the rest of the world looks up in on us sometimes, and maybe the traits that we might treasure in Texas don't go over so well in the rest of the world. I know that, ironically, Texas might very well bring an end to the death penalty with some of the excesses and problems that are there, but not because they want to. I'll take my comment offline. Thank you.
Gail Collins, maybe you could speak to that. It isn't you didn't delve into that as much in your book, but it must have come up.
Yeah, the death penalty, it's weird. I was trying to really do this book in a very hard-minded way in terms of just thinking about things that Texas did that really did slosh over the borders and affect the rest of the other people in other states in a very serious way. And the death penalty, although your caller suggests that that Texas has been instrumental in encouraging, you know, setting an example for maximum use of the death penalty, it's not one of the things I think in which the uniquely Texas attitude toward criminal justice affects the rest of the country. But it certainly is unique.
Bill?
Well, our newspaper has engaged in a campaign to try to end the death penalty here in Texas, so I guess I'm going to be on the side of that. I think it would be important for the state to change its policies. The caller pointed out that perhaps some of the excesses we have had here will lead to that, and that very well may be the case. But I would agree with Gail. I don't think that's the biggest way in which the state may influence larger national debates. If I may add here one thing where Gail talks about in her book, she's right. We have too many minimum wage jobs here. But if you look at the data for Texas recently, where we're adding jobs in 8 of our 11 major industries, and 2 out of the 3 sectors that are adding jobs at a particularly high rate are the professional business services and oil and gas. And both of the average wage in those sectors is greater than the average wage in Texas as a whole. So I don't think it's that we're just adding minimum wage jobs. We are adding minimum wage jobs, but it's not only that. We have had our unemployment rate is now at 6.9%. We've had 8 straight months of lower unemployment. And I would say, and I'm not saying this is a way to thumb my nose at other states, but I have a feeling that other states would like to have an economic record of a record of growth as opposed to not having growth over the last 8 or 9 months. So there must be something that is happening here with a model that is lower tax and less regulation than, say, California or perhaps New York, that could have some impact on our economic growth.
But Gail, you actually did take quite a look at that. And in fact, California, it's often compared to Texas in terms of jobs creation. Texas is quite aggressive about courting jobs from other states. I mean, I think all states are told to compete now, and Bill's absolutely right. What state wouldn't love to have a good track record of jobs creation? But maybe you can drill down on that a little bit.
Yeah, there are a couple of things, and it's absolutely true. Bill is absolutely right that Texas has had an economy that, in terms of jobs growth, that most other states would really give an isthmus or a peninsula for anyway. But one thing is that Texas is also exporting some of its philosophies about how the working people of the state should be treated. For instance, Texas has been very aggressive in making it difficult for workers who are injured on the job to sue for disability payments and compensation. And their system that they use is being exported to other states. And that kind of stuff is – it's another sloshing over that you have to look at. Also, Texas has this thing. This is not the biggest thing in the world, but it just drives me nuts, this thing that called the Enterprise Fund, mm-hmm. in which Governor Perry or his representatives will go to other states and attempt to basically bribe the other companies to move to Texas. And the idea that one state would use taxpayer funds to go and try to take a company away from another state and then encourage the other state to use taxpayer funds to bid it up and keep the company there, that seems to me very wrong. I think only Texas could go to France and try to do that, but it just seems extremely wrong to do it to other states in this country.
You also say that if low taxes and low regulation were all it took, then Mississippi should be first in the nation in terms of
education. Yeah, you have to look at when you decide what it is that Texas did that makes it such a growth engine for jobs. You have to look at stuff like the fact that it's got this huge border with Mexico, which has been an incredible job developer. It has very cheap housing, which is something that I keep telling people in the rest of the country they have to look at, although it's partly cheap because there are fewer regulations, there's much less zoning, but it's really true, and there's all that space for it. But besides that, there are parts of it that are very hard on low-income workers. There's no safety net to speak of for poor people. You know, getting Medicaid if you're an adult is almost impossible in Texas. Getting help if you're mentally ill in Texas and you're poor is really, 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 really hard. And stuff like that makes a difference. And all the people who are being educated in Texas now in schools that have been cut to the bone by the budgets over the last several years, those people are going to go out into other states and they're not going to be as well prepared as they should be.
So you're saying one of the things it's really driving is the whole notion of income equality, inequality. Let's take another call here from Bruce. He's calling from Berlin, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Bruce.
Hi, Jackie. I seem to recall there was a movement somewhere in Texas that they were in favor of seceding from the Union at one point. And I always thought that would have been actually a very good plan, because it probably would raise the average IQ of the remaining country by several points. That's my only comment. Thank
kind
you.
Of a, kind of a Texas bash there, Bruce. But Bill, first of all, Texas can't secede from the Union. But what about the points we were talking about a little bit earlier, that a lot of this growth has come at the expense of slashing what we would think of as educating and providing a sustainable environment?
And I'd argue that is not necessarily all true. Let me throw some more data out here. If you look at our scores on the national exam called NAEP, which is kind of the gold-plated exam that is given across the country. Over the last 20 years, since we've started a model of what they call consequential accountability, which basically is the idea that you're going to have these annual tests and schools will be assessed on how well they did. And if you continue to fail over a period of time, then the state has the right to intervene. Over the last 20 years, the scores on the NAEP for Texas Hispanic have gone up the equivalent of 3.5 grade levels. And Texas Hispanics are now 14 points ahead of Hispanics nationally. That's in eighth grade math. I could go through other data for fourth grade math that would echo those findings. But the point is that Gail is absolutely right. We need to deal with the large number of Latino kids who are coming through our schools. Half the students in public schools in Texas today are Latino. But I would also argue that we are making strides and we are making improvements with the kids who are both Latino and African American.
Gail, you also write about No Child Left Behind and the whole charter school and voucher system coming out of really Texas San Antonio. Would you talk about that?
That's one of the interesting byproducts of the No Child Left Behind legislation that nobody, as far as I could tell when I asked the people who had been involved in the negotiations, understood was going to be part of the deal. The fact that public education was going to be giving more and more and more of its taxpayer dollars to private companies for one thing or another, for things like running charter schools, for tutoring programs that generally don't seem to be working at all, for massive, massive, massive amounts of money for testing, because each state has its own individual test. And Texas alone, I think it's a $500 million contract right now out in its latest test group. And I have to say that the guy who did the main negotiating for the White House is now a lobbyist for the largest test-making private corporation in the world. But all these things came out of Texas because Texas had itself, when it was trying to reform its own schools, a difference between the people who thought that the answer was to give more resources to the schools and the people who thought the answer was more accountability, more testing. And nobody could ever quite figure out which of those two things was important. But more and more, the conservative wing, including people in Texas, have argued that it's the accountability end of this that matters the most. It's having the tests, having the accountability, not more resources.
Well, and don't you like that Texas is 43rd in high school graduation rates and 45th in SAT scores? Is that correct?
It is. Yeah, and that's the problem with scores in general is that there are so many scores running around out there. It's very, very hard to tell which scores are the definitive scores. And the Obama administration, I think to its credit, is trying to get all the states together to work out national standards so that you can actually judge these things and compare one state to another. And Texas has refused to participate in this effort.
Well, Bill McKenzie, I'm awfully glad that you participated with us today. Thank you so much. Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Dallas Morning News. And I also would like to thank my guest, Gail Collin, national columnist for The New York. Gail Collin's new book is As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and you are listening to On Point.